So thank you for joining Marianne Gabauer podcast. And I am delighted to be joined all the way from the UK with Ian Davis. Ian, thank you for taking the time for chatting with me today.
Oh, thank you very much, Marianne. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So Ian, so many people know who you are, but for those who are not familiar with your work, you are a top-notch independent investigative journalist and author. You're a frequent visitor on Unlimited Hangout. You collaborate with them. You write for UK Column. You're on the Corbett Report. You write for Off Guardian. So you freelance, and I think of you as one of the solid voices of reason in an upside down world. So thank you for your great work. And
oh, thank you very much.
I just appreciate your perspective.
Yeah, thank you very much. I also write for Geopolitics and Empire as well.
So. Oh, that's right. That's right. And you're a frequent guest with them.
Yeah.
So let's start off. Why don't we start off talking about the digital prison and what exactly you would define this as in today's world?
Yeah, I think it's a difficult thing for people to grasp because the way that it's being constructed is piecemeal. It's being constructed piece by piece. So I think we're all used to using our devices, you know, our smartphones, and you know, it's pretty ubiquitous, isn't it? And we use the internet all the time, and everything is increasingly done online. And we especially saw that during COVID, where the increase in the volume of custom that occurred online shot through the roof, and it's never really returned. We're still more and more we're using, you know, online to buy things and sell goods, but that's all great, and it's all very convenient, and that's how most people view it. They view it as convenient, but what most people perhaps are not aware of is that behind the scenes, organizations such as, you know, the World Economic Forum, but not just there, many, many different organizations, the Bank for International Settlements, certainly the central banks, are viewing this system as a control grid. So they're hoping to integrate the system that I've just talked about with things like smart cities, you know, and also through using things like central bank digital currency and digital ID, we will be situated on the smart grid. So you will have a parallel digital ID, much like at the moment you've got a parallel birth certificate. So you've got this thing called a birth certificate. A lot of people talk about a thing called a Sescovay Trust, which is your official persona as you are known to the authorities. This, you've got this thing that identifies you as a person. Increasingly, that will be our digital ID, which will be a biometric ID, and our digital ID will be linked to our physical ID. So our physical ID will place us on the digital grid. And when, you know, the World Economic Forum talk about things like the fourth industrial revolution, what they're talking about is digitizing everything. So the devices in your homes will be linked, you know, they will monitor your energy consumption, for example. Your vehicle will monitor your energy consumption, your whereabouts, your devices will monitor your whereabouts. And so the potential to use this as, you know, what people talk about a dystopian control grid is definitely there. But what's more alarming than that is that there are plenty of people around the world and plenty of governments around the world that are making every effort to turn it into that dystopian control grid. So people probably aren't so aware of that as they go about their daily lives, but it's happening. So as certainly I think the key things to look out for are the introduction of digital identity, which will... You know, myself and Whitney Webb have recently written quite extensively about Sustainable Development Goal 16.9, which is a commitment to give digital ID to every person on the planet. Once that digital ID is in place, it is through that, and certainly through the use of central bank digital currency or digital tokens, digital money, that our behavior can be controlled. So I think those are the things really to look to be wary of: digital ID and central bank digital currency, or variation of it, which would be various forms of commercial digital tokens.
So I think we often look at China and we look at the social credit system there and we think, well, that's rather extreme. But then we do have it oozing into our systems here. In Canada, we've had two bills passed, Bill C-11, Bill C-19, which is censorship and monitoring of your online behavior. You've got the new online safety bill in the UK, which is much of the same. So do you think that the powers that be are just introducing these in a softer way in Western countries, in a more palatable way that may go unnoticed?
Yeah, I mean, I recently wrote a piece as well, quite a lengthy piece for Geopolitics and Empire about precisely that topic. I would suggest that really the only reason that we ever talk about a quote unquote social credit system is because China gave it a name. China has got a lot of a raft of legislation and not so much legislation, it's more like party policy documentation and legislation to form to formally create this thing called the social credit system. But what China is creating really isn't any different to the exactly the same system that is being rolled out everywhere else. So, for example, let's take the example of Alipay. So, Alipay is a facial recognition. Alipay launched something called Smile to Pay in China in, I think it was 2021. So this was a facial recognition system where you could go into, so your face is your biometric ID, so that identifies you as an individual. That is linked to your digital ID, which is then linked to your cash wallet. So you or your digital wallet. So you can go into a store in China, purchase your goods, and all you need to do is go where this is operating. It's not operating everywhere. It's being trialed in China at the moment. You can go up in mainly in big cities like Beijing. So you can go up and your face can be scanned, and then the funds will be automatically deducted from your digital wallet. That is Smile to Pay in China. Now, Everett, that sounds like, so again, this is sold to people as convenient, safe, secure. But what of course it also means is that that data is then stored on a centralized database. So that data is then being gathered by the payment providers, in this case, Alipay. And the intention is that what they're calling the two-tier payment network will settle those transactions. If you imagine millions of those transactions taking place every day, will settle those transactions in central bank digital currency. So even though you might think you're just using Alipay's Smile to Pay system and it's coming out of your digital wallet and you're not too sure what the tokens are in your wallet, you're actually going to be using the plan is that you will actually be using central bank digital currency, and that database will go, well, in China's case, it would be the Chinese Universal Ledger or the Chinese National Ledger, whatever they're going to call it, which will be part of the Bank of International Settlements Universal Ledger. So the Universal Ledger will have oversight of every transaction on Earth. So what that means is if you use software and certain providers will be given licenses to be able to access the ledger. So they will be able to interpret and interrogate that data to pretty much find out anything about anything you've ever done. So they'll know what you had for lunch. You know, that kind of surveillance is possible through a system like this. And that is being created in China. But I think the danger is that people then say, oh, China's bad and China. The reason that I wrote the piece was to point out that yes, this is being done in China, but it is being done everywhere because you've got the same facial recognition technology being rolled out in places like Houston, in Philadelphia, in the States. You've got it. It's in London. It's in. We've got a supermarket, a European supermarket called Aldi, which has just said that it's going to be releasing a number of these stores. Putting a number of these stores across Europe. So these are staffless stores. You go in, you register your app to you know there's a physical barrier that you have to pass through to go into the store. You pay with your face or with your biometric data app and leave the store. There's no staff. The start that the you just go in there and buy stuff. Now, that's where retail is heading. So if you think online retail as well, obviously that's tracking what you buy because you're forced to use digital forms of payment for online retail as you're going to send envelopes of cash through the post, which no one's going to do. So this system is being created, which will monitor every aspect of our lives in minute detail. And that's common to China, and it's common to the US and Canada and the UK and Europe and everywhere else.
So essentially, you're punishing or rewarding people based on their compliance, and you essentially have the courts and credit companies and social media all cooperating and collaborating and sharing intel on you.
Yeah, and I think the thing is, the argument comes up, if you've done nothing wrong, you've got nothing to worry about. People often say that kind of thing. But I mean, if we can look to your own home country of Canada, what happened to the truckers? And I think what was really interesting to the in the truckers protest was, yes, the truckers protest organizers had their bank accounts frozen and couldn't access funds, which meant that the truckers movement couldn't access funds. So we're already seeing this link between banks, which are private commercial entities, private corporations, and the state. So when you've got the state, the political state, and private corporations merging and working together to enforce policy, excuse me, excuse me, that is fascism. That is the definition of fascism. So you've got this thing coalescing, this thing coming together, of these entities coming together. Now, the interesting thing about what happened with the truckers' protests, I think, and the way that they froze the bank accounts, was not just the fact that they froze the bank accounts of the people that were organizing it, but that they made it impossible to make payments through payment gateways, things, these GoFundMe kind of pages. You couldn't make a payment to support the truckers. So even if you as an individual Canadian felt like you just wanted to give $10 to support the truckers' protests, you physically couldn't do that because the payment gateways were barred. Now, if you look at what digital ID and central bank digital currency and digital tokenization will deliver, and we have people like Bo Lai, who's the deputy director of the International Monetary Fund, openly discussing this, and people like Augustin Karstens, who's the managing director at the Bank for International Settlements, talking about how this will enable us to force policy decisions through. We will be able to enforce policy because people will have no choice but to obey it. So, for example, the idea of the 15-minute city, goes back to something that the Wilderness Project is, but is very much integral to things like sustainable development and Agenda 2030. With something like central bank digital currency linked to digital ID, what they would be able to do is disable your money so that it doesn't function more than 15 minutes from your home. So it's not that there'd be like some physical wall stopping you going more than 15 minutes radius from your home. It's just that beyond that point, none of your money will work. You won't be able to buy anything. You won't be able to buy any food, any fuel, anything. So you're physically trapped because through that mechanism, through a digital prison mechanism, there's no bars, but you are already, and that's got nothing to do. And so then we look at the likelihood of that being used to silence dissent. So if you're an undesirable person who the government thinks is a rabble rouser or supporting a truckers' protest, A, you won't be able to support the truckers' protest, for example, because your money won't work. You won't be able to make that transaction to support them. But let's say that you decide to buy some media or support a certain media outlet. Perhaps you might donate to Marianne, or you might donate to myself to support our work. You won't be able to, because your money won't, you physically won't be able to make that transaction work. So that is the dystopian nightmare that we are, it seems to me, pretty much, you know, if you think about the general population, we are blindly walking into this under the guise of it being sold to us as convenience.
Yeah. And very often we're not even aware that this is being used. You know, I passed through Heathrow last year, and my son and I inadvertently exchanged boarding passes. And at the gate, they blocked me and they said, "This is not you. You are not who you say you are." And I'm like, "Excuse me, this is my boarding pass. This is my passport." And then they showed the picture of myself, and it was my son with a baseball cap on that they had taken at the airport somewhere along the way. And so here we were being blocked from getting on our flight because our image that they'd taken unbeknownst to us did not match our identity. And that was a little bit disconcerting.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? Because there's an error there. They've obviously got the names mixed up when they.
Oh, no, we actually exchanged. We by inadvertently mixed up our boarding passes. I was holding my son's.
Ah, I see.
But it was the picture that, and it was a photo that had been taken while we were at the airport. Because then when we examined the photos, it was what we were wearing. So at some point, they took a photo of us. But I found that somewhat of a violation. I thought, you didn't get my permission to take my photo. Why? I have my passport. Yes, we can sort out the business with the boarding pass, but I, you know, here they are. They're gathering intel on us without our permission.
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is, they're doing that all the time. I mean, I mean, one of the things that people are often concerned about, you know, is their privacy online, for example. There isn't any privacy online. If the authorities, or certainly the intelligence agencies and people like that, if they want to know what you're doing, there's nothing you can do about it. They've got the technological capability, and they've long had the technological capability, things like the PRISM program and stuff like that. They've long had the technological capability to monitor everything we do. Now, that rather makes a nonsense of, you mentioned it earlier, of things like the Online Safety Act. So the Online Safety Act has been put forward, and similar legislation in Canada. Is it Bill C? No, it wasn't Bill C-16.
No, we have two bills, C-11 and C-19.
C-11 and C-19, yeah. So bills like that, the idea is that this is to keep you safe. Mm-hmm. So to keep you safe online, to stop people, you know, in the UK, it's certainly to, the idea is that it will keep children safe online. Now, for a start, criminals don't care what laws are. No criminal cares what a law are. If they cared, they wouldn't be criminals. Mm-hmm. So people like paedophiles don't mm-hmm. care that it's illegal to abuse children. They simply don't care about that. So changing the law means nothing to paedophiles. Mm-hmm. Accessing things online and accessing systems online, no paedophile is going to register online using their own name, their own face, and their own identity to abuse children. That's not going to happen. No paedophile's ever going to do that. All paedophiles, or nearly all paedophiles at the moment, access things like Facebook using the dark web. The things like the Online Safety Bill and Bill C-11 are not going to change that. What would change that is getting Facebook to shut down their dark web portal. But nobody seems to be bothered about that. Then you get a situation where, so the people are going to use fake IDs. If everything is designed to go through digital ID, you just already talked about a mix-up at an airport. Now that was your fault in this instance. But as we've seen digital ID rolled out, it's in places like for populations like the Rohingya in Malaysia, but for populations like that, And populations where they've already rolled out digital ID payment systems, which I would say that people like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, they always start with refugees. They always start with the most vulnerable people. So when you look at what's happened to those populations, the errors. So, for example, one of the things that they use to register refugees in projects in Africa are retinal scans. But as you get older, your retinas deteriorate. You get things like cataracts, and your retina becomes unreadable. So what that's resulted in places like Uganda is elderly people not getting food aid because they can't, their eyes don't register on the system. So it's not as if having a system of digital ID is going to make us all much safer. Quite the opposite. If you think about the propensity of identity theft, if everybody's got a digital ID, and the lack of protective legislation that doesn't exist while and regulation while all of this is being rolled out, it's like the Wild West of data gathering. There are going to be kids in internet rooms in Krakow that are downloading data and selling it online for fun. It's an apps, the idea that any of this is going to keep us safer is totally ridiculous. If
It's
you're
ridiculous.
I mean, if you are someone that is intent on harming others online, such as a paedophile or let's say a terrorist, you're going to buy fake ID. You're going to buy it and you'll use that. It's the idea that this keeps us safe is nonsense. All of this legislation is about one thing. It is about surveilling the population. It's not about keeping us safe. It's not about protecting us. What it is about, it's about, if you imagine the early days of the truckers' protest in Canada, it is about intervening at that early stage so that people can't communicate with each other and organize any kind of meaningful resistance to government policy. That's what it's really about.
Exactly. And we saw that in Canada. GoFundMe, GiveSendGo, both of those mediums where you or platforms where you were able to support a movement that you believed in were completely blocked. And to add insult to injury, the hearsay is that the government orchestrated this. But a couple months later, a master list came out that was public all across the country. Of all of the names, addresses, telephone numbers, sums that were given, and comments that were made, all of the donors and their location on a big Google map where they lived exactly, their home addresses. So all of a sudden, these donors were very, there was complete transparency as to who they were. And that made a lot of people feel very vulnerable.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's the
It's
nature of
outrageous.
the, yeah, I mean, and that is the nature of the system that they're suggesting to us will make us all safer. It's
Exactly. But it was
totally
a form of
ridiculous.
shaming. It was horrific. And I've
Yeah.
heard from some reliable sources that the government was the one that hacked these databases and released it on a beautiful Google spreadsheet.
Yeah. I mean, who knows what these people do, but I mean,
Yeah.
it's certainly not safe. I mean, normal. No, I mean, and that I think that goes to another thing as well. I mean, to what extent are people willing to pursue their safety at the expense of their liberty? I mean,
Yes.
one of the things that struck me and a number of other people during the COVID lockdowns, which we're now increasingly finding out were complete nonsense. I mean, there were people at the time, and I'll include myself in that were pointing that out at the time. But there is no, even if you've got this terrible disease, which I would strongly argue COVID certainly wasn't, but even if you've got this terrible disease that is inflicting people and causing mass deaths and mayhem, does that justify giving away all of your liberties and rights? Is that a reason to do that? Now, a lot of people would say, well, yeah, that's a reason. I disagree. I'm one of those people that say, no, that is no reason. Just because something bad is happening in the world, that doesn't mean that you should give away all your freedoms and your rights. In fact, if anything, at that moment, that's the moment when you need them the most. That is the moment when you need to be able to exercise your freedom of choice. It couldn't be more crucial at that moment. You know, when risks are at a very dangerous level, then that is the moment when you surely need to be able to exercise your freedom of choice, not the time when it should be taken away.
Exactly. No, it's an outrage when we look back now and reflect upon what was imposed upon us, upon society. It's appalling. It's appalling that there was compliance. Were you surprised at how much compliance there was?
I n no, I wasn't particularly. I mean, even if I go, if even if I think about my own close family circle and my friends, you know, most people, and I understand this, and I totally get this. You know, Marianne, there are not many people like us that spend a lot of time thinking about this kind of stuff and are concerned about it. Most people just want to get on with their lives. You know, they just want to go to work. They want to raise their families. They want to enjoy their lives where they can. And they watch the mainstream media and they go to sport at the weekend and enjoy themselves and go for walks and go fishing, and they don't think about this stuff. So when the government says jump, you know, it's dangerous. People are educated from the moment they go to school, a state school in our system, to obey authority, because they're taught that is the right thing to do. So when the government says, you know, we've got this terrible problem, we need to do something about it, this is what you will do, people just go along with it automatically without even thinking. It never even occurs to them that there may be some sort of nefarious agenda behind it. It's not even on their radar. So when people like myself start pointing things out, and your good self start pointing these things out, people find that very, very, very difficult to believe, because it's contrary to their whole kind of concept of what their polity is that they live in is based upon. And sadly, it often takes things like the truckers' protest, where suddenly millions of people see, you know, in stark reality what government oppression looks like. It takes that to mobilize people, to get people moving. And, you know, and unfortunately, you know, we're seeing that constantly at the moment in the world. I mean, people don't react until it's too late. And a big part of you know, certainly the work that I do is about trying to encourage people to take measures to mitigate what's coming down the line, and to stand against it, you know, rather than just passively accept, you know, what is happening.
So what is, give me your top five suggestions to mitigate or block this trend, not trend, this imposition.
Yeah, well, I mean, I you know, this is where we run into ve very hot water. So my number one, don't vote. Right now, the reason that sounds like a petty thing, and it probably is only a symbolic gesture, but the point is, every time you vote, you are giving legitimacy to the system that inevitably produces tyranny. Now, that is because authority produces tyranny. As soon as you give, or you create, a political elite or a political class, inevitably they will seize more and more and more power, and that means more and more and more oppression. And currently, that's happening on a global scale. We're seeing some of the type of rhetoric and the type of extreme political opinion and arguments not operate. I mean, something that we might have seen, so for example, in the ni in 1930s Germany, or something that we might have seen in 1920s Russia, Soviet Russia, we are now seeing that type of rhetoric on the global stage. So we're now seeing people like Gutierrez talking about the disease of misinformation and how it needs to be cut out of society. Now, that sort of stuff is something that you might have expected someone like Hitler to say. So inevitably, every time you vote for a political system, all you're doing is supporting that system, in my view. I know a lot of people will disagree with that.
Now, okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate. I would say, should you not vote for the candidate that you think you can have the most effect on?
This is a lot. No, not in my view, because in my view, it doesn't matter who you vote for. It is the act of giving away your own authority which is the problem. It is the fundamental concept in the belief in authority,
Right.
as in you think you ought to devolve your own agency to someone else so that they can tell you what to do. That's our problem. That is the
That's right.
crux.
So by not voting, you're really getting your head in a different space where you're not granting anyone else authority over your life, your existence.
Yeah,
You
well,
don't play, you're not playing the game.
no, and I, you know, so personally, I mean, and people say, oh, this is arrogant and pointless. So I personally, nobody has authority over me. No, there is no human on this planet that has any authority over me. And I can say that because it is absolutely true. Now, so people say, yeah, but that means you can't just disobey all the rules and not do what the government tells you, otherwise you'll get arrested. I absolutely accept that. I totally accept that. Of course, I can't break the law, but nor do I want to break the law. It's not like because I don't accept authority, I'm suddenly going to go outside and steal someone's car. I don't accept authority, but nor, but I tell you, I do accept full responsibility for everything I do and every action that I make. So I accept my responsibility not to harm others. I accept my responsibility to care for others. I accept my responsibility not to be, a menace to society. That's my responsibility because I'm a human being, I'm a social animal, and I live in social groups. It doesn't matter to me that there's a law that stops me from doing something. It does. That's irrelevant. It's whether or not it's right what I do. If I do something that is wrong, I'm the first person to know it. If I do something that is wrong, there will be repercussions for my actions. I accept responsibility for the repercussions for my actions. I just don't need somebody else to tell me what to do.
Got
Now,
it.
I think that society ran along those lines, which means we'd have to accept things like natural, we'd have to not accept, we'd have to understand things like principles of natural law. We'd have to understand what that means, what the non-aggression principle means, what responsibility for ourselves and others actually entails, which means that we cannot devolve decision making to some other entity. We have to take responsibility for it. If we had a society that was constructed on those principles, we'd have a very different society, what some people might call a voluntary society. So that's just number one. So how
Okay.
will we do that? How will we do that in a practical basis? So
Yeah.
how? So in talking about resistance to this tyranny that is coming down the line, I am all for all forms of lawful and peaceable protest. So protest marches, tax strikes, boycotts, all those kind of things, they're all really important, and they're all important way. Lobbying, if we can get together to lobby decision makers, all that stuff is all really important. And it all helps further the cause of standing up to what's coming our way. But unfortunately, the people that really make the decisions, who are above the heads of people like Tedros at the World Health Organization, they're above people like Schwab at the WEF. They are the people in the upper echelons of, the Bank for International Settlements, the global financial institutions, they don't care really what our politicians do, say, or think. What they care about is what we do, say, or think. So through whatever mechanism that they can control us, whether that's what they call a democratic political system or what they call an autocratic political system, it doesn't really matter as long as our behavior is controlled. And that's why we've got things like the Fourth Industrial Revolution, digital ID and CBDC, because it's all about controlling our behavior. Because in order for them to get what they want, we must comply. If we don't comply, there are 8 billion of us. If we decide we're not going to comply, that's it. It's over. It's finished for them. There's nothing they can do about it. So don't comply. That's the most important thing. Don't comply. I mean, it's interesting that we were talking earlier before we started, we were talking about our experiences during the lockdowns. And you noticed how draconian the lockdowns were when you were coming in and out of the UK or trying to live and work in the UK. I can honestly say that I didn't know anything. Well, I did know about the lockdowns, obviously, but they didn't mean anything to me. They meant nothing to me. I just completely ignored all of it. I just didn't comply with any of it.
The five mile radius that I heard that people, you know, were stopped on the highways and asked to show evidence of their address. Did you just go about your merry way, go wherever you want, and you never had any issues?
No, never stopped, never asked of anything. You know, even senior political figures in the UK, like Dominic Cummings, who was the chief advisor to the Prime Minister at the time, just ignored it. He didn't stop him driving off to see his family with his children in the back of his car, right at the height of COVID restrictions, driving off to see his elderly parents. The people that were in charge, we had like Boris Johnson's now infamous Partygate, where, you know, he was having parties and drink soirees with his chums, because they didn't care. They weren't interested in the laws and in the regulations. None of this was law, by the way. It was all just mandates and suggestions. People went along with it voluntarily.
Yeah, it was really the peasants who complied, and they looked upon us as a peasant class.
Yeah.
When in my travels during COVID, we met a lot of millionaires and billionaires, and they were all happily living their lives. They were all using ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine prophylactically. None of them were getting vaccinated. They were flitting around the world in their private yachts and their private jets. To them, COVID didn't exist.
No. That's quite obvious now and it didn't exist for the political class either, obviously.
Obviously.
I mean, even at the start of COVID, we had people like the Scottish, the chief medical advisor for Scotland, and her name escapes me now, at the height, I think the day after she announced pretty strict COVID restrictions, she took her kids on holiday. Right? It was only in people's imagination that this stuff existed. If you didn't imagine it, it wasn't there. And I would suggest that the same is true for the pandemic. If you didn't think there was a pandemic, there wasn't one.
You're very right in that. If you had never turned on mainstream media and you went about your life, you would not have noticed excess deaths, because there were none. Now the stats are out. There were no excess deaths. You could have gone merrily about your life and ignored everything.
Yeah.
And that, in a sense, that's what we chose to do. We chose not to come back into Canada because we disagreed with everything that was going on. And we chose to stay in countries like Sweden and Greece until they imposed a lockdown. And then we left, and then Costa Rica, where there were no, nothing was imposed on us. We had complete freedom. But I mean, that was a luxury in a sense. I understand a lot of people weren't able to do that, but we were able, we were in a position to do that. But it's catastrophic how people bended to the authority, and they must look back with such anger now to think that they lost years with loved ones, and they did not gather as a family. They didn't see loved ones in care homes, and
Yeah. I mean, the truth, I
they
think.
banded to a vaccine and they had no idea what was in it.
No.
And now, the anger that must be out there.
And that, so that probably moves me on to my next point about, so if you're gonna protest in the streets, one thing that I'm very much opposed to is violence. And it is tempting, as we have seen recently in Israel, when oppression is so severe and violence seems like the only way out, the only option, even then it doesn't work. And the reason that it doesn't work is because it plays into the hand of people who we bestow with the only legal authority to use violence. There's only one institution that can lawfully and legally use violence, and that's the state. If I go up to another individual and tell them to empty their pockets, and if they don't agree, hit them on the head with a baton, I can't do, I don't have that right. There's no, I can't do that. I don't have that right. Now, we are told that the state gets its rights from us, that we devolve our rights to the state. How do we devolve that right to the state? We don't have it. We never had it in the first place. It's not a right that any human being has. So how can the state possibly have that right? How can the state have the right to come up to you and force you to do what it says? And if it doesn't, it'll beat you up and put you in a cage, or worse, as we're seeing in Gaza at the moment. Just wipe you out, just slaughter people, commit genocide. So only governments can do that. Only states can do that. So why would you ever support an institution like that? Why? It makes no sense. So if you are enticed to go on something like a protest march and violence occurs, that only suits those that are that empowers those that use the language of violence. It empowers them. And they benefit from it because it enables governments, for example, to crack down, to introduce new draconian legislation to control your violence, actually, as we are seeing at the moment in Ireland.
Oh, Dublin, terrible.
Yeah, but that doesn't hurt government. It supports the government, it enables the government, it empowers the government. If you want to challenge the policies of the people that are ruling us and want to hurt them, then use the violence of your money, use the violence of your wallet. Stop buying their goods and services. Stop paying your taxes for as long as possible and for as hard as you possibly can. Go through the courts, bung up their courts. Don't use just brutality to try and get what you want. Use this. Use a bit of cunning. Use a bit of guile. Do things like, I mean, I remember during the poll tax, one thing that we had this unlawful, terrible piece of legislation called the poll tax in the UK. So what people were doing were there was a 6-week assessment period, right? So you would get this form where you had to fill out your form for the poll tax and send it off. And then what the trick was to 6 weeks later, because you knew how long the assessment period was, to send in another form saying that your situation had changed. You'd got a new dog or you'd moved house. And then 6 weeks later, send in another form saying your situation had changed. And just keep doing that. Now, millions of people did that in the UK, and the government could not enforce their tax because, simply for the fact, not because people were rioting in the streets, although that did happen, but not because they were rioting in the streets, but simply because they refused to pay it. They just wouldn't pay it. So the government's only option then is to put the people through the courts. Well, it hasn't got enough courts. It couldn't put millions of people through the courts. The courts system would have collapsed. And so it gave up and it nearly brought down the Conservative government at the time. So that is our power. Our power is collective action. So if we refuse to be locked down, if they say we're going to lock you in your houses and go, oh, well, in that case, we'll have a street party. If they say, you know, you can't drive to go and see your grandmother, so you go, oh, right, well, we'll take a busload of people to go and see my grandma. That is how we will be able to resist the government. And from my perspective, it's the government, but it could be any authority that is trying to oppress you. That is how we would resist it, by using affirmative action and doing things like using what we might call counter economics, which is not buying things from global corporations, but supporting your local trader. Go and buy, it's less convenient, but go and buy your food from the farmer's market. It's better food. Yes, it's a little bit more expensive. And yes, it's a little less convenient, but you're supporting local producers that don't then need to suffer the whims of global corporations that won't meet their food quotas. So we can do this by building better communities. The solution to a new and better future is not smashing to pieces that which already exists. It is ignoring that which already exists and building something better, building a better alternative. That's how we will defeat the thing that we oppose.
You know, these are really excellent practical examples of how to resist. Do you have any comment on an initiative I heard in the UK where people are paying their taxes, but not giving them to the government, but putting them in trust? And apparently it's in the legal system right now, and the courts don't know what to do because people have paid their taxes, but they're not remitting them to the government. Have you heard anything about this?
No, I hadn't. Oh, I hadn't, but that sounds very interesting because that's exactly
what I spoke to someone here in Canada who seemed to know more about this, and I thought, what a clever idea.
Yeah, no, it sounds
people
like...
People are afraid not to remit their taxes.
Yeah.
But in this case, they have remitted them. And it's on the record, but they're not remitted to the government. They're in trust. So I think that might be a very interesting situation that we should find out more about. But do you have any other practical ideas? You said you could give us five. You probably have already given us that. But do you have any other practical ideas? Because I think this really helps us wrap our head around in a practical way, how we can resist united non-compliant. I mean, we hear this, but.
So, I mean, you know, things like, so the idea of counter economics, which I just briefly mentioned, but mm-hmm. counter economics can go a long way. So for example, you know, how many of the things that you own at the moment do you actually need? If you pare down what you actually pare down the things, if you separate out the things that you want from the things that you need, you will find that the list of things that you need is actually quite small. Mm-hmm. Now, if you then decide, well, where do I source the things that I need? So I've already given the example of, for example, food. Where do I get my food from? We need food, so where do I get my food from? So then you might think, well, what else do I need? Well, I need clothes. So where do I get my clothes from? So instead of going and spending, you know, hours traipsing around, you know, modern supermarkets and trying to get the cheapest thing you can, like a cheap T-shirt and a cheap jumper because it's cold, go to a local charity store. Go to a local charity store. It might take longer. It might be more inconvenient, but get the thing that you need and support something like your local hospice. So your local hospice, who shouldn't even need to ask for money but does because the government that we elect doesn't prioritize things properly, support them. If you think about every decision that you make every day, and there's something that I talk about, it's something called acceptance and commitment. So if we accept that what we want is a better life and more freedom, and we want to protect the freedom that we've got, and we want to be able to exercise our inalienable rights, if we think that that is our goal, then if decision we make, we consciously accept that that is something that we want, and accept that there are things that we cannot change. So we can't change the government. You can't change them. It doesn't matter who you elect. If you elect another one, just another set of bods will be in there, and they'll make the same policy decisions as the ones you just got rid of. So we can't change them, but we can change what we do. So, for example, buying our clothes from a local charity store and supporting a good cause, a hospice, buying our food from a farmer's market. If every decision we make consciously accepting the things that we cannot change, and then consciously commit to moving towards our goal, even if it's a little step, like not paying for anything with anything other than cash, insisting on cash. If you go into a shop and they say, oh, sorry, we don't accept cash, go, well, okay, thank you very much. I'll take my business elsewhere and go and find somewhere that does accept cash. Little steps like that. If we do things like that every day, then it is not hopeful that we will achieve our goal. It is inevitable. It's a nailed on inevitable certainty. And certainly if we do that in sufficient numbers, so we're not confronting anyone, we're not being violent, we're not waving banners, we're not protesting for some cause. We are simply moving towards the thing that matters to us. And if we do that in sufficient numbers, we will achieve the thing that matters to us. We just got to do it in sufficient numbers. But that mass is created of one individual, of lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of individuals. So if we say, think to yourself, if you wake up tomorrow and think, I need someone to lead me, to tell me what to do, where I should go, what decisions I should make, then just look in the mirror, because that is the only person that you need to reference. You need to decide for yourself what it is that you think you should do to move towards the thing that's important to you. And that's, if we all did that, because how many of us want to go to war? How many of us want to see our loved ones, you know, die alone? How many of us want to see children blow to bits? How many of us want to see criminals running around on the streets? How many of us want any of this? No, we don't. The peaceable people of the world, if we just act in good conscience and forget about what those idiots are telling us to do, then we will create a better world. And as I said, it's not could, it is inevitable if we did that.
Well, it really is a complete paradigm shift where you need to look inward and think very carefully about your own behavior and be very intentional.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for those practical thoughts, because I think this is something that we're all struggling with. We have limited time, and do we write a letter? Do we sign a petition? Do we attend a protest? Or do we change our daily behavior?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's and, you know,
and we can, in addition.
We can do all of that stuff, but I mean, there are practicalities, right? You can't just not pay for fuel, right? You can't just not pay your energy bill because you'll get cut off, right? Yeah. Now you might think, okay, so I want to get off grid. That might be a long term goal. So my long term goal is to get off grid. Right. But in the meantime, of course, I have to pay for fuel. I have to pay for all these necessities. They are necessities. I need to feed the kids. I need all of that to happen as well. So it's not a matter of, you know, dashing yourself against the rocks in some sort of noble kind of sacrifice, because that's no use either. If you're not around, you can't help build anything. You know, people need to, as I was saying earlier, think about this kind of more tactically, more aware. But think, and that's a good example. So another thing you can do is set long-term goals. So my long-term goal is to live off grid, you know, reduce my carbon footprint if you want, you know, do the things that are important to you contribute what you can wherever you can to your community and to those, and support the people that you love and support the people that are near you, and work mm-hmm. together collectively to move towards the things that are important to you and your loved ones. That is all we have to do. That's all we have to do.
Exactly. Well, I'm going to switch gears here quickly. I know you don't have too much time, but I really want to talk to you because I think of you as a geopolitical expert. I want to talk to you about Russia and Ukraine. That story has lost steam. We're really, no one's talking or thinking about it anymore. And now we have the Israel-Hamas situation. Do you see a connection here? What's your perspective on what's going on?
Yeah, I see a connection from COVID through Ukraine to where we are at the moment with in Israel. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first thing I would say, far more people. I mean, it's almost awful. It's hideous to even make this statement or calculation. But the rate of killing in Gaza is unlike anything we've seen, even in, outside of dropping a nuclear bomb on somewhere, that the ferocity and the rate of killing in Gaza is not even comparable to things that we saw in the Second World War. It is horrendous. So the only thing that really matters, and I struggle to get beyond this, is that it stops. That's it. It's just got to stop. Now, people will say, obviously the argument is, Hamas will rearm and stuff. So what? That doesn't matter. Nothing could be worse than what is happening right now. What is happening right now is that children are being blown up in their thousands. It's just got to stop. So nothing is more important than that. But going back to what you were saying, if you think that the purpose of the COVID, I would call it the pseudo pandemics, and what books called pseudo pandemic. If the purpose of that is to put in place a system which controls our behavior through establishing a new normal of commitments to behavioral norms. So mm-hmm. that's the idea. It starts introducing us to the idea of what the philosopher Giorgio Agamben called the state of exception. So you're always in this state of exceptional circumstances which require you as a citizen to respond in a specific way. So the state determines what the circumstances are, and the state tells you how you must respond. Now that is what happened during COVID. That's what people were trained to be accustomed to during COVID. So then that starts to tail off because, people started realizing, for example, I think that they had to start covering up the fact that mortality was not going down. It was actually going up after they'd released the jabs. So that all needed to be covered up. So that's quite, start to wind down the COVID narrative. Then we get a war in Europe. So we get this next state of exception, because what we are told that causes is in Europe, and in America as well, to a great extent, a cost of living crisis, because that's affecting the global economy, but most acutely in Europe, of course. So that is affecting the global economy. Everything starts going up. Inflation starts going up. It's all Vladimir Putin's fault, apparently, which is nonsense, right? This thing is happening. This event is happening. The history of how that war came about in Ukraine goes back to the Maidan coup, which was orchestrated by the US State Department, which it's a war in the Donbass that had been going on for 8 years. Russia entered it, or rather Russia escalated it. Russia certainly didn't start the war. But then again, you might wonder what Russia are doing now. Why didn't they do something 8 years ago? There's all these kind of questions around it. But the overview, if you stand back and look at the overview, what that means is we're in another state of exception. We're in this time of tumult, this time of unbalancing us, subconsciously and psychologically unbalancing us. Mm-hmm. Then that inevitably, that war couldn't continue. Russia had no need. I mean, Russia pretty much fulfilled its objective. It had secured the Donbass. It had got new, you know, Ukraine was not going to join NATO. There was no chance of that happening. Its gas pipelines are still flowing through Ukraine, which they did throughout the war. You know, Ukraine is still getting transit fees for the Russian gas pipelines that are going through the middle of it, which nobody seems to. But Russia was still selling oil to the Ukrainian military through Lukoil and its deal with the refineries that were coming out of Bulgaria, which is crazy. I mean, 40% of the Ukrainian military was running on diesel that was manufactured from Russian oil. I mean, it's just crazy stuff. But that's the way that these things roll, because it's never what we're told it is. So then we move to this thing that's happened in Israel, which is so shocking, I think, to millions and millions of people, that it is starting to destabilize the foundation of everything that they believed about their own societies in terms of the roles of their own government, especially in the West. I mean, people are looking at our governments now. People are given what is happening to the Palestinians, which interestingly is being broadcast. This is all being broadcast on Western television. Suddenly the West is suddenly, you know, talking about the plight of the Palestinians, something which is practically ignored completely for 75 years. Now it's all about the horror, and I'm not denying that for one moment, the horror of what is happening in Palestine right now, in Gaza right now, and in the and we're not not just Gaza, and in the West Bank as well. The horror of what is happening there as a result of, you know, what we are told was a terrible terrorist attack, and certainly a lot of innocent people died. Quite who killed who, there's a little bit of a question over that, given that, you know, we now know, for example, that the Israeli Defense Force have pretty much admitted that they were guilty for a lot of the deaths at the Reem Music Festival. So how many people? But it's almost terrible to get into these numbers. It doesn't really matter how many people were killed by who. The fact is, a lot of innocent people died. That's what is really important. So this again is perpetuating this idea of destabilization. I heard the IMF, sorry, the World Bank have now said that this situation is going to increase global financial instability. If that increases global financial instability, if there's a prospective global financial collapse, then the solution will be central bank digital currency. So it's all part of a continuum, and it's all the machinations of great powers as they jostle for position into what is increasingly obviously going to be a new form of global governance, which is going to be whatever people might call it, the multipolar world order. But what it really means is that there's going to be a more multifaceted form of global governance where other states, not just the West, so it won't be just the G7, it'll probably be modeled more around the G20. So other states like Russia, China, Brazil, India, you know, the other these are Indonesia, these are other countries are going to get more of a say. More African countries, hopefully, will get more of a say in global politics, as if nation states have any say over global politics. Because if we look at where global politics and policy agendas come from, it isn't nation states. There's a I talked about something about the Global Public Private Partnership, which is a global network of governments, NGOs, philanthropic foundations, academic institutions. They all form a network through the think tanks like the Club of Rome, the Club of Madrid, the WEF, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderberg Group. All these people, these think tanks come together and they develop policy agendas like Agenda 2030, Sustainable Development, which is then rolled out across the world, which it has been. It's been rolled out across the world, and no government has ever voted for it. Governments then convert that policy agenda into policies in their country, and then those policies get filtered down to impact us at the local level. decisions are not taken by governments. They're not taken by the people that you elect. These trajectories, policy trajectories, are formed in the think tanks with people like, Augustin Carstens, people like that, making these decisions, which most people don't even know who these people are. But that is how global governance works. And then beneath that, we've got geopolitical tensions, which are manipulated and used to make us behave in a certain way. And I see a very clear linear progression from the start of the COVID fiasco that started in 2020, all the way through to where we are now with this horrendous situation in Gaza. It's all part of the same trajectory, and it's all leading us towards instability and ultimately where we started this conversation, which is the control of us as individuals through digital ID, central bank digital currency, a biometric surveillance state. That's where we're going.
So, would you say that this whole situation in the Middle East has been orchestrated as a means to an end?
I mean, I've recently been looking at, I've got a piece coming out shortly where I am asked the question, was Al-Aqsa flood what we might call a false flag attack? So was it orchestrated? If you look at the history of Hamas, it is very difficult to see that they would exist in the form that they exist now without the Israeli state. The Israeli state supported the creation of Hamas. There is no doubt about that. The Israeli state has also assisted with the funding of Hamas. Hamas wouldn't have any money if it wasn't for Israel. Israel, I mean, Netanyahu has spoken about this quite frequently, but there are many. It's not just that. It's that support for Qatar to enable this flow of money from and through Israel and from the West. The United Nations have been supporting Hamas because UNRWA, the organization that gives relief aid to the Palestinians, itself acknowledges that about a third of everything that goes into Gaza gets siphoned off by Hamas. So it knows that the aid is being siphoned off by Hamas, and it I totally accept that there's not much UNRWA can do about that. I get that, right? But nonetheless, that aid is going into Hamas, and the funding is going to Hamas, and it's acknowledged and admitted and conceded. Israel, for many, many years, governments of Israel have argued vociferously that Hamas should be funded, that Hamas is there to divide the Palestinians. It's to divide, Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. It's to break it up, to divide and conquer, which suits some Israeli Zionist, I mean Zionist in the political sense, in the strict political sense, which is what Zionism is. It's the hard right, hard line Israeli Zionist interests in, the Likud party and in Israel itself. It very much suits their interests that Hamas does what it does. Now, does that mean that it suits their interests that Hamas then attacks Israel and kills people? Again, when you look at it, it's difficult to see beyond the massive. I mean, I think people need to understand that the scale of Israel's capability, intelligence capability in Gaza. So we are told that it was an intelligence failure, and a lot of people have forwarded that argument. But failure doesn't even get close to describing the total collapse of what would have happened, what is arguably the most eye-watering surveillance and intelligence operation ever in the history of humanity. I mean, they've got six satellites looking, these OFEX satellites, scanning Gaza constantly, drones flying over it, drone swarms flying over it. They can hack into all communications in Gaza. They can, the human intelligence, they've got, Maglan, the Maglan units and that work inside Gaza. Hamas is absolutely paranoid. I mean, it's been paranoid for years. It's killed loads of its own people because it's so paranoid about the degree of Israeli infiltration in Hamas. It can't do anything without Israel not knowing about it. So the idea that Hamas Nightmare could organize Al-Aqsa flood, which apparently, took 2 years. I mean, let's remember that they were using tractors and heavy machinery, right? I mean, Israel, there's no way that Israel didn't know about it. The more you look at it, I mean, not only that, Israel had plenty of warnings, plenty of warnings. There were people living near Gaza, Israelis living near Gaza, that were talking about it on the radio before it happened. Local people saying, we know what's coming. We've seen them. Hamas put a video out in September of them, of the Al-Aqsa flood operation, of them doing it. They put a video out on their social media channels, but Israel didn't know anything about it. It's not plausible. It's not plausible, not in any way stretch of the imagination. I'm concluding. I haven't concluded the piece yet, and I haven't finished researching it. But as far as I've got at the moment, my view, and it's my opinion, right? So it's just my opinion. It doesn't mean anyone. I never ask anyone to agree with me. I never ask that. I'm just saying what I've found out and what I'm looking. The information that I'm looking at, the information that I have, very much suggests to me that it was a false flag of the let it happen on purpose variety. So they knew it was coming and they did nothing to stop it. So the question is why? Why would they do that? I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I haven't got that far. What I'm starting to look at are things like, the Ben Gurion Canal is one possibility. This idea of being a, certainly with Egypt and Saudi Arabia joining the BRICS, they're going to have kind of a lot of control over the Suez Canal. Is that a reason to push ahead with Ben Gurion? Possibly. But also Israel's deeply involved with the Belt and Road Project. Its biggest port that is being built by China. So it's a very complex situation. I mean, one of the things that I don't think that we shouldn't overlook is the thing that I was talking about earlier. If you really step back and look at the big picture, is this about global manipulation and the potential construction of a multipolar world order? Because the situation in Gaza is such at the moment where people might think, how can we possibly resolve this incontractable problem? How can that be resolved? We can't rely on Israel to resolve it because Israel clearly wants to kill all Palestinians. Nor can we rely on the Palestinians to resolve it because they clearly want to commit terrorist attacks against this. You could see this logic forming. So that means that, we can't have the normal intermediaries, Egypt and Qatar, who are the normal intermediaries for these things. We can't really rely on them either because it's not working. It's not resolving the problem. So what is the solution? The solution is better global governance. Now, one thing that really struck me through this was Antonio Guterres' scathing attack on Israel. Now, I can't remember the precise words that he used. I can't remember the precise words that he used, but to hear a UN Secretary General attack Israeli policy the way that he did, to practically accuse them on the global stage of genocide, is I've never heard anything like that from such a senior figure like that. I mean, that's just to do it so openly and aggressively, and then to have a very public argument with Israeli officials about what he'd said and what they, I mean, I just thought this is wacky stuff for that kind of General Assembly type kind of level. And I am suspicious that, that also plays into the agenda of being able to resolve this intractable problem with better global governance. So, I mean, I don't know is the answer why it's happened, but it certainly seems likely to me that it was a let it happen on purpose false flag at this stage. And I'm not even sure that that is Israel necessarily that are letting it happen on purpose. They're obviously involved, but I think there's more to it than that.
So it's a, the timing is very convenient though, because it allows new systems to be put in place.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, talking about surveillance. So Israel recently passed a law allowing more facial. So Israel has got this incredible facial recognition network that it uses in the Palestinian territories. So in the West Bank and in Gaza, not in Gaza, because obviously that's difficult inside Gaza because Hamas will just take them all down. But at the checkpoints and at the crossings in and out of Gaza, and certainly throughout the West Bank, this probably, outside of places like China, probably, and London and cities like that, a really full-on facial recognition system that is tracking people, their movements everywhere. Well, prior to this happening, interestingly, there was also a legal move by the Knesset to introduce the same kind of scale of facial recognition tracking in Israel, because their argument was that they needed to be able to maintain security across Israel as well. So this certainly helps play into that narrative. I mean, that certainly kind of suggests that, we need to be more vigilant, this kind of argument to keep people safe. Financially, Israel are moving towards launching their central bank digital currency. You've got this financial instability that is caused by what happened. There's lots of moving parts that suggest motive, perhaps, for allowing something like that to happen.
Right. It's the perfect excuse as well. If the financial markets go sideways or there's a collapse of the markets, you can always blame it on war.
Yeah, which is exactly what they started with the Ukraine conflict. I mean, Ukraine has been, I think people, I am gonna have to shoot on because I've overdone, but Ukraine has basically been colonized financially. It has borrowed so much money from, the World Bank, from the IMF, from financial institutions, from foreign governments, the US government, the UK, the European governments. It's in hock up to its eyeballs. And, in terms of its economic sovereignty, it's sold that. It's gone and given away to foreign governments.
Right.
So it's almost like Ukraine, while Russia have been militarily fighting, and Russia's military war absorbed so much investment from the West, the US sending billions and billions of dollars in military aid to Ukraine. Russia's just kind of absorbing this, sitting back behind its lines, just shelling and firing missiles. And I mean, I'm not for one moment saying that it wasn't a that the people in the Donbass stuff, weren't fighting for their lives. I'm not saying that at all. What I am saying is that from a it, this absorbed a lot of money. It absorbed a tremendous amount of money, which has resulted in Ukraine losing its sovereignty, really. Ukraine, and not to Russia, it hasn't lost its sovereignty to Russia. It's lost its sovereignty to Western governments, who have now divided it up into basically into a system of contracts. So, the Ukraine's going to be rebuilt, and people are talking about it being the new kind of center of sustainable development, and and in terms of digital technology, a hub of digital technology with its Dear app, which is an everything app where every Ukrainian, has their digital ID linked to this single app that does everything. I mean, that is ripe for the development of all the kind of technological fourth industrial revolution type innovation, the innovation hubs. Has been created by that situation. And that's in Ukraine.
And in addition, is war not the best way to facilitate a transformation? for wealth.
Yeah, and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, we're talking about that in 1908. You know, I
It's
mean, they you know, I think it was Norman Dodd, wasn't it, who you know, he for the church committee, that was it, church committee, I can't remember. You know, that you know, what is the best way to transform a society? Can you, is there, I think the question that was asked of the Carnegie Endowment was, is there a better way to transform society than war? And its answer was no, there isn't. It's the best way to do it.
very efficient. Are there any good guys here?
Yes, we are the good guys. I mean, I don't mean you and I, although I hope we are. You know, I mean, we are, we the people.
The people, but you'll hear people talk about nations that they think are the good guys.
Yeah,
Are there any?
I don't think so. I mean, but that's because I'm a Pope. Yeah, so because I fundamentally reject the idea of authority, then obviously a nation state is the antithesis of the way that I would envisage things progressing. But you know, although we go back to the argument that we are the good people, right? So if we look at Nigeria, right? Nigeria, the nation state, so the nation state of Nigeria. The Bank for International Settlements and the Central Bank of Nigeria tried to enforce central bank digital currency on the Nigerian people. The Nigerian people didn't have any of it. The Nigerian people just refused to comply. They started using alternative systems of payment. I mean, they went through tremendous, I'm not for one moment saying that the Nigerian people didn't pay a heavy price for this. I mean, they cut them, a lot of Nigerians off from cash, which was their only way of trading. So the Nigerian people faced tremendous hardship because of this, but nonetheless, they did not comply. They would not accept the government's central bank digital currency. They wouldn't accept the loss of cash and protested vociferously against the loss of cash. They then realized that the government was going hardball on not allowing them to use cash, and so and therefore developed alternative payment systems for themselves. Now, we're not talking about a small country of not many people. There's 225 million people live in Nigeria, and they sorted themselves out. They sorted themselves out, and basically the government had to back off. Now, it certainly hasn't given up. The government hasn't given up, and it is continually trying to roll out and legislate to make things harder and harder and harder for the people of Nigeria. But that is an example. When I talk about who are the good guys, we are the good guys. The Nigerian people are the good guys.
That's right. Are there any other countries? I agree with you. The example Nigeria is brilliant because it was the first major visible rejection of central bank digital currency. But are there any other countries that you see visibly resisting the globalists effectively?
Not effectively. No, I mean, there was. I mean, Switzerland had a. You know, they forced their government to hold a referendum on cash, on retaining cash. So the Swiss did that, but unfortunately, the government does to, doesn't have to. The Swiss government doesn't have to abide by any of the referendum decisions. So that's a little bit. You know, it's a great gesture, and the Swiss government would certainly hesitate to disobey one of those votes, but it hasn't allowed the vote yet either. So, I mean, you know, there's that. I mean, then you get the kind of populist kind of political leaders. Geert Wilders, in obviously in the Netherlands, has just been got 37% of the vote, didn't he? So, I mean, you know, he's in a position to potentially form a government. Similarly, in Argentina, you've
We
got
have
yeah.
Javier,
You got
Millet or Mill, yeah,
Millet, yeah, I
Millet.
can't remember. I mean, he's certainly a character, isn't he? So I mean, you know, for comedy value alone, I think he's you know, interesting. But the problem that I always come back to, and then one of the things that I noticed, that one of the first state visits that Javier Milei, how do you pronounce it?
I think
Milei,
it's Millie, but yes.
Milei. Javier Milei is going to do is visit the US and Israel. So I don't know whether that's, you know, most people that get in a position of authority. I mean, I would suggest, you know, perhaps a slight anomaly is Donald Trump, right? So Donald Trump gets into a position of power when he wasn't supposed to. I don't think he was supposed to get into that position of power. So they fixed the next election, to make sure that he didn't stay in power, in my view. But he couldn't do anything when he was in office. I mean, he was hobbled as a president, or as a leader, as a functioning political entity, from the moment he walked into the Oval Office. I mean, he was just constantly, you know, stymied at every turn. So it's not like, you know, if the wrong person gets into office, then they're stopped. They're not allowed to do anything. You're only
Exactly.
allowed to do something if it goes along with the globalist narrative. If it goes along with the globalist policy trajectory, then that's fine. You can impose all the draconian measures that you want if it's in the name of sustainable development, but
Oh
you
yes, well look in our country. Look at our Trudeau. He's
yeah.
the perfect cap. Do you have any comment about Kennedy? Because he's a little bit of a fly in the ointment. The latest polls came out of Harvard
Yeah.
showing him as a front runner. He's a favorite in the US.
He is, but honestly, you're asking the wrong guy about political leaders. I mean,
Yeah, well, that's right. Because in
to
your
me,
mind, politics are irrelevant.
yeah, politics are, well, they're not irrelevant. They're not irrelevant because millions of people believe in it, right? My hope is that they stop believing in it. But I can't deny the fact that millions of people do believe in it. So they're not at all irrelevant, because I do care about what people think, but and believe. But I just wish people didn't, because I know that they're just banging their heads against the
Yeah,
wall.
there's a
So
futility. Yeah.
yeah, there's a futility from my perspective. So if we take Kennedy, yeah, sure. I mean, he's, you know, obviously, I mean, he's had a lot to say about COVID. He's certainly had a lot to say about the vaccines, but he still pushes forward the official narrative. He's very pro-Israel. You know, it's still the globalist narrative. I mean, everything that he said, even everything that he wrote in his book about Fauci, which is an excellent book and, you know, well worth reading, highly recommended. Even that was still pushing through the notion of this terrible pandemic that is causing devastation, and you know, it's still the promoting the official narrative. Now, is that because he genuinely believes it? It may well be, and I'm not, you know, it may well be because he genuinely believes it, but I fundamentally disagree with him on those things. So, even if you, someone like Kennedy, even if he was elected to office, what I'm suggesting is that if he got into power, the chances of Kennedy, for example, overturning the law so that you could prosecute Pfizer in a court in the US is nil. It won't happen. It's not going to happen. The Supreme Court won't allow it. You know, it's not something that will happen, because it's not part of the policy agenda. I mean, maybe you could see someone sacrificing BioNTech. I mean, that's the sort of thing that they would do. They'd throw a if it was not, you know, important to the agenda, they might throw a small bank like SVB, or they might, or a small smaller pharmaceutical corporation like BioNTech. They might throw them to the wolves and let them get beaten up in the courts. But they're not, then Pfizer's not going to go down. AstraZeneca's not going down. Moderna's not going down. You know, so these buyers not going down. You know, these corporations are embedded. They're embedded in the polity of the country, of the world. So if you want to know, if you want to, the decisions that politicians take are in their interests, always in their interests, especially in the Western world. Less so in maybe the global south, but in the global south, they're being exploited. Neo-colonialism is happening in the global south. Sustainable development is a pathway through which that is happening. Investment, global investment banks investing in the global south, creating incredible debt poverty for nation states in the global south, which will then be exploited to get what they want, which will be natural resources, coal, iron, all the rare earth metals that are needed for our new bat system for batteries, which no one needs. I mean, that's what will happen with that process. So of course you get the occasional, Sankara, for example. You get the occasional political leader that comes forward, Nelson Mandela, although not in every respect, but in some respects, Nelson Mandela, people like that step forward and capture the public imagination and genuinely try to help their people. Of course that happens. I'm not saying that all leaders are bad, but overall the system is not designed to enable those people to flourish. It's designed to enable global corporations to flourish and certainly international financial institutions.
Right. So my last question is, what is next? What, give me some predictions. How do you think this is going to play out?
Well, I think I would be very surprised if I don't know how long the situation is going to last in Israel, but I think within the next few months, probably, we'll see here more and more calls for improved global governance. There's going to be this admission by everyone that the situation is intractable, and the only way to solve it is. See, the thing is, people will agree with that, and rightly so, because the only way to resolve an intractable situation is through negotiation and collaboration and negotiation. That's the only way anything can be resolved, of course. So people will agree with that. And I think that will be used, and I think that that is what will happen. It'll be used, but it's the product of that. The product of that, I strongly suggest, will be revamped systems of global governance. And I think that is very much the theme for as we get closer and closer to 2030, that is going to be the theme that will become more and more and more pressing. And I would suggest that since 2020, since the start of what I would call the pseudo pandemic, we have been pushed along this trajectory precisely because as we approach 2030, they want to have firm global governance in place by 2030. That's what 2030, the big 2030 target, that's what it's all about.
And the end game really is one world government. But
Yeah.
are we going to see a tremendous rivalry of who's on top? You've got these competing parties, China, you've got Russia, you've got the West. What is there going to be a big rivalry, or do you think they're all in cahoots?
No, I don't think they're all in cahoots. I think there is help, healthy. It's not healthy at all. There is significant rivalry between factions within what I call the global public-private partnership. But that includes the upper echelons of that, the think tanks, and that you get people that take over. You get power struggles within the Royal Institute of International Affairs. You get that kind of thing. You've got the Carney camp and the Ben Gurion camp. You've got the you have these constant struggle for supremacy, and I see no reason why that shouldn't be happen within in terms of the struggle for supremacy between the Eastern powers, I guess the Eurasian powers, you might say India, China, the BRICS, Russia, and the West, which is vying for its slice of the pie. Broadly speaking, I think the West is set for decline. I mean, that seems quite obvious. If they want to introduce a kind of level playing field, which I think they do, I've written about that as well, going back to Mark Carney's 2019 speech at the Jackson Hole, where he talked about something called a synthetic hegemonic currency, which basically meant a leveling out of global reserve currencies so that they're all on a par. And when they're all on a par and the interest rate is more or less stable, then you can introduce CBDC because it'd be just a direct swap when you want to make transactions. They really want that. Well, in order to do that, the Western economy has to decline somewhat. The global South certainly economically needs to be lifted up. And Eurasia, the developing, the emerging economies need to be able to complete their project. So the Belt and Road project and all that sort of stuff. So that I think that will happen. We will see a global rebalancing of the economy. And many people say, well, that's no bad thing. And I agree. It wouldn't be no bad thing if it was organic and if it wasn't leading to global governance, because what comes with global governance is very bad. What comes with global governance is, for a start, a separation between you and the policy decision makers. I mean, even in, that's bad enough in a democratic country like Canada. There's this separation between the people and the decision makers. I mean, imagine it at a global level. Imagine Trudeau's not a Trudeau. You can't even lobby. There's no point lobbying Trudeau because all your policy decisions are being made by Gutierrez. And what are you going to do about that? Nothing. So that's coming. But with it comes central bank digital currency, digital ID, biometric surveillance, the fourth industrial revolution, the end of human freedom, and digital enslavement for the global population. That comes with it. So even though you might say, oh, well, the global rebalancing of the economy would be good, wouldn't that be great? It would be, were it not for the fact that it comes with enslavement of the global population, which it will.
So where does this end?
Well, I think, hopefully, I don't know. Who knows? I mean, I would. I mean, it's the so Agenda 21, right, is where they've really got to set up the idea for the fulfillment of global governance in the 21st century. So a lot of people think, you mean, I've talked about Agenda 2030 and this, but 2030 is a waypoint along the way to Agenda 21. Agenda 21 is really about the creation of human settlements and the construction of quarantine zones and zones that people can't go into, protected zones, as in whole swathes of the earth that we're not allowed out into. I mean, that's Agenda 21. So that's projected. That's what they want to achieve in this century. With the greatest respect, you and I will be long dead by then. It's so up to 2030. I mean, David Icke, right? David Icke. I don't let me get this right. I'm not a great fan of David Icke, right? But nonetheless, he said some quite good little things. So he called it the totalitarian tiptoe. So you incrementally. You keep making these decisions that sometimes those increments are so small that people don't even notice that, oh, they've stopped us using unleaded petrol. Oh, they've stopped us using our cards in Waitrose. Oh, we can't use cash now. These little things, these little steps that people accept. But when you step back and look at the net effect of all these little decisions that the government have taken on behalf of people like the Bank for International Settlements, what you're doing is in gradually moving towards total oppression and enslavement. And it's a clear trajectory. All your freedoms are being taken away, and you're being required to behave yourself in more intricate ways. So, how do we, if we go back to what I was talking about earlier. If enough of us wake up to this reality and just say, nah, well, we're not doing it. Now, if you say that I've got to use my central bank digital currency to buy food, then I'm going to grow my own food, or I'll find someone that does grow food and I'll strike up a deal with them so that I can eat food that they grow. We will have to cooperate. We will have to work together. I mean, one of the interesting things about individual sovereignty, when but people from an anarcho-capitalist perspective often talk about individual sovereignty, that doesn't mean separation. It's the opposite. What it means is cooperation. It means that we, as individual sovereign beings, respecting each other's values, have to learn to cooperate with each other. Because if we don't, the people that rule us are just going to tell us what to do, and it's just going to get worse and worse and worse.
But do you suspect then there'll be a group of us that do not comply and are living in parallel to those who have chosen slavery?
Maybe,
And
I mean,
will we be allowed to coexist?
Well, it won't be easy, will it? I mean, they won't want people to do that, and they certainly won't want people to advertise that, you know, and advertise it and suggest it to other people. Like I've just spent the last couple of hours doing, you know. But you know, it's I don't think we need to worry too much about what they might react to. I think we just need to set up the systems that we need as and when we need them. What would be good if we were already preparing to do that? And there are people already preparing to live life outside of the system. And that's what all that we really need to do as
That's right.
individuals. Once we are living life as independently as possible. See, if you can cut your reliance on the state, so you don't need them for money. You don't need the state for your energy. You don't need the state for your healthcare. You don't need that. Once you start weaning yourself away from them, as the situation gets worse, the people that have weaned themselves away from it will get together and start collaborating. You know, that's out of necessity. But whether that means that there'll be some sort of breakaway society or something like that. I mean, I've got no idea. But you know, the hope would be that over time we would all realize the benefit of that, and we would all start breaking away from reliance on others. It's not just reliance on the state, it's reliance on others. We have to be autonomous if we're not self-sufficient as far as possible. But self-sufficiency doesn't mean exclusion. Self-sufficiency means communal self-sufficiency. I cannot grow food. I can't grow food. I've got nowhere to grow food. So I have to rely on others that do grow food. But there are things that I can do in exchange for that. And that's what commerce, well, that's what Catalaxy is about. That's what counter-economics is about. It's about exchange, and it's about how we function. Which we've done for millions of years, by the way, or hundreds of thousands of years. I mean, that's how human beings have functioned for hundreds of thousands of years. It's not like this is new. It's not like something that we've just invented. Government is the new thing. Government is the thing that we, you know, and leadership, that's the thing that we've only had for a few thousand years. Nation states are 200 years old-ish, you know, 300 could say. You know, nation states are not an ancient concept. We didn't have them going back, you know, go back 500 years, and nation states were a far less solid structure. They were shifting all the time. Principalities were pulled out here, and you know, it was a far more fluid thing. So even things like that is not set in stone. Change is the only, you know, as it says, change is the only constant.
Well, Ian Davis, this has been a fascinating conversation. I have really appreciated your opinions, your perspective, your insight. Thank you so much for your generous time. I'm sorry to have kept you this evening, but thank you, thank you. And I look forward to chatting again.
No, I'm really enjoying it. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk. And I'm sorry I rambled on.
No, you didn't ramble on. No, it was fabulous. So thank you.
Thank you.